Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island, pairing beer and music since 1988. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago, Illinois. Listen critically, enjoy responsibly.
This is Sound Opinions, and Greg, we are going to blow out the entire next hour to discuss the Velvet Underground and Nico, the most important, most influential, and certainly a record that means more to us than any in rock history.
No doubt, Jim. I think this is the most influential band in rock history, and this is where it all starts for me in a lot of ways.
Different album. Lou Reed sang this line years later on Loaded, talking about Jenny, this mythical young girl on Long Island, discovering rock and roll, and her life was saved by rock and roll. I feel that way about this album, The Velvet Underground and Nico. I know you do. For those who don't know this record, we are going to make the case at the end of it about why they need it in their life as urgently today as they did in 1967. Who were the musicians that make this record? Lou Reed, first and foremost, singer and songwriter. He is born in Brooklyn, but moves to Freeport, Long Island at age 11 with his quintessentially middle-class Jewish-American family. He's a troubled kid, Lou. You know, there are pictures of him playing sports in high school, kind of a standard upbringing, but he had wild mood swings. There was depression. His father, in particular, subjected him to electroshock therapy, something Lou never got over, addresses it in the song later, Kill Your Sons. Comes out of Creedmoor State Psychiatric Hospital in 1959 and goes on to Syracuse University. Lou is enamored of the beat poets, and he develops a relationship with the poet Delmore Schwartz as his mentor. Delmore is up there in Syracuse, famous for his 1937 short story In Dreams Begin Responsibilities, drinking himself to death and influencing Lou Reed. Little known fact, Greg, Lou played records on college radio, an equal mix of Ornette Coleman, Cecil Taylor, and Don Cherry, and his R&B favorites, Hank Ballard and James Brown, with a little bit of doo-wop. I think that pretty much tells you where Lou is coming from. Up at Syracuse University, he meets one Sterling Morrison. Sterling's impressed by Lou Reed because he will take his guitar, crank it up to 11, and blast out the window at the ROTC cadets marching by below. Sterling says, I got to meet this guy. They're also friends with a guy named Jim Tucker. Jim has a sister who you'll introduce in a minute named Maureen. It's really interesting. Lou Reed, the Tuckers, and Sterling Morrison all grew up within about 8 miles of each other on Long Island. Okay, what was in the water producing these people? But that musical partnership begins between Sterling Morrison as a great rhythm guitarist, sometimes lead, and Lou Reed, a man who said, you don't understand rock and roll if you have never picked up a guitar. Guitar was everything to Lou Reed.
Absolutely, Jim. And the third member of this troika that is really the foundation of the Velvet Underground was John Cale. Now, he's the outlier in the group in a lot of ways. Three of the four members, original members of the Velvet Underground, were from the Northeast. And, you know, that was the core of the band, New York City.
Yeah.
Here comes John Cale from Wales. He is a classically trained musician. He studied music in college, came to New York in the 60s, and started performing with something known as the Theater of Eternal Music, sometimes later referred to as the Dream Syndicate.
I always wanted a bed that could fly in the sky on starry nights, on cold starry nights when you laid snuggling in your bed and feeling sorry for all the cats that had to be out walking the city streets on such a cold night.
This is an interesting collection of characters. You had Cale joining Lamont Young, who was one of the most famous experimenters in the 60s art scene. as well as a guy who fathomed himself as a drummer, Angus MacLise, Tony Conrad, a hugely respected violinist, Billy Name, who later fell in with the Andy Warhol factory crowd in New York City, John Hassell, an artist who worked with your friend, Ding, Brian Eno, later on down the road.
I wasn't the first to bring him up, although we will.
But soon, Cale was fascinated with this character, Lou Reed. He told me when he first saw Lou Reed working out his music, he was really impressed with Lou's ability to improvise lyrics atop of almost anything, come up with really dynamic, provocative, bold street scenarios, painting these narratives of New York City street life, unlike anything he'd ever heard or seen in the music sphere, certainly pop music, but was coming straight out of literature. People like Bukowski and Nelson Algren.
Hubert Selby Jr.
These kind of, you know, kind of brutally honest writers. Hearing that coming out of Lou Reed's mouth made him want to work with the guy. So here's these three guys holed up working on music together. Lou Reed, Sterling Morrison, and John Cale.
I'm waiting for the man. Take three.
All we need is a drummer, right? MacLise is the first guy who's brought in as a drummer. He's an obvious choice.
You know, it must be said, I edited a book about the Velvet Underground. You have been studying your whole life, as I have. Many of these stories are apocryphal, but this one is repeated so often, I think it must be true. Angus MacLise was such a hippie, he didn't like the idea of being told when to start to play and when to finish. So they get a gig in, of all places, Summit High School, Summit, New Jersey.
Right.
They have to play. They're getting paid to play. He also didn't like being paid to play. This was art, man.
Yeah.
So he doesn't – he bows out. They turn to Jim Tucker, their buddies. And you know anybody who plays drums? My sister Maureen.
Yeah. Maureen Tucker grew up in Long Island. And as you said, her older brother was a friend of Sterling's. She was the – you know, we need a drummer. Who can we get? Well, Sterling's friend plays drums. Let's get her in the band. Now, here's this essentially untrained drummer, and with quote marks around untrained. Maureen was fascinated by drums from an early age, and here's this kid growing up on Long Island, and her two main influences on banging pots and pans and whatever she can get her hands on are Baba Tunde Olatunji, the great African drummer. He put out a very famous percussion record in the early 60s that influenced scads of people around the world.
Well, there was one of these cultural efforts to bring him here to play in America, and she went around her high school with the coffee can collecting money. So she wanted to hear her hero, this drummer.
Absolutely. And the other influence, Bo Diddley. You know, the Bo Diddley beat. You know, rhythm was her life, and untrained, but certainly playing air drums and real drums in her bedroom, wherever she could find a hard surface to bang on.
Not all
stunning drums.
Drums, though, Greg.
Yes.
It must be said. She turned a bass drum on its side and stood playing it with mallets, sometimes a floor tom, on very special occasions a snare drum, but none of the traditional kit instruments, all of the tom-heavy, bass-heavy, bottom groove.
And cymbals were just verboten.
Anathema.
I don't need those. Don't need those. So a very odd, looking lineup of people here. You know, you had these kind of arty guys up front, and then you had Maureen, who was sort of regarded, again, quote marks, the primitive in the group.
Well, she looks like a Peanuts character,
yeah,
essentially, when you see those photos. And it must be said, she never gets enough credit. Mm-hmm. There are beginning to be, in 1967, when the Velvets released their first album, some women in rock in influential roles. You know, Jefferson Airplane, Grace Slick, okay? But nobody playing an instrument. Maureen Tucker is really the first serious instrumentalist in a rock band.
And Lou Reed recognized that special quality from the start. There was no condescension at all. As soon as he saw Maureen and what she was trying to do, he was in love with her as a musician. He said there are two kinds of drummers. There's Maureen Tucker and there's everybody else.
Spoken with love. What happens to this band of misfits? How do they get from Summit High School to the nexus of cool in the art universe in the mid-60s? They get a gig at a place called the Café Bazaar. This is not a cool Greenwich Village place. This is a tourist trap where tourists come along and they want to hear beatnik music, weird music in Greenwich Village. Well, the Velvet Underground are playing a stint there. They're way weirder than anybody bargained for. They play the Black Angels' Death song. Says, you play that again and you're fired. So they play it again and louder. They're fired. But in the crowd, apocryphally perhaps, but so the story goes, that night are two members of Andy Warhol's factory crowd. One of them's Billy Name. He introduces them to Warhol. Who is Andy Warhol in 1966? Greg, it can't be understated. He is the center of the art universe. This is the moment of pop art. He is at the height of his powers. What is pop art? I think if, you know, Warhol wrote an excellent book about it called Popism. But I think if we have to distill it to one sentence, Andy said, the pop idea was that anybody could do anything. So naturally, we were all trying to do it all. All right. So he's making movies. He's cultivating what he calls superstars, Edie Sedgwick, people like that, Candy Darling. And coalescing this group of talented misfits in this silver foil lined loft in New York City, and the Velvets fit right into that. When he takes them on as the musical act he will present in the same way that he would present his lithographs or his films, it instantly says one thing. This is capital A art. Right. And this is where the notion. Now, nobody said this. Sgt. Pepper's is several months away when the Velvets, actually more than a year away, mm-hmm, when the Velvets begin recording. This notion that rock can be art and not just teenage juvenilia. This is new. Having Warhol as your sponsor is serious.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, you got to consider the context of what's happening in the rock world when eventually, the first Velvet Underground record is released in 1967, the Velvet Underground and Nico. That was released in March of 1967. You point out that they were recording this record a year,
yeah,
ahead of that release date. When this record comes out, what is the context? I mean, we are on the doorstep of the Summer of Love. West Coast psychedelia is ascendant. Flower power, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. We're going to change the world, kids.
San Francisco, not New York.
Yes.
Maybe London. Those are the centers of the world, not New York.
Don't do anything at all. Go ask Alice when she's 10 feet tall.
The Velvets were not in step with any of this. The Velvets hated psychedelics. They didn't like to drop acid. They were into harder drugs than that.
They were into speed and they were into heroin. We'll talk about both.
And they looked askance at the idea that taking psychedelics was sort of painted under this picture of a spiritual experience. Man, we're gonna see new things and we're gonna create music under its influence. They were really skeptical, cynical about that whole notion. They saw and wrote about reality. They wanted to rub the audience's noses in it. Andy Warhol sort of put it best. Instead of leaving them wanting more, It was always leave them wanting less.
There's one more ingredient we have to add. Andy Warhol, the role of him in producing this record, aside from putting his name on the Velvets and designing the cover art, the famous banana, which comes with a sticker, peel slowly and see, it says to the Velvets, I think you should meet this woman, Krista Fafkin, but she's known as Nico. Born quite possibly in Cologne, maybe in the years before World War II, all of these facts are very mysterious. She's one of Europe's beautiful people, Greg, an actress, a model. She's in a Fellini film. It's only natural that she'll eventually make her way to New York. She's already recorded by the time she makes her way to New York, a single produced by Jimmy Page for Andrew Luke Oldham's, the guy from the Rolling Stones, his label. Warhol says, I really think you should have this woman, you know, because the Velvets at this point are like, Andy's going to pay for our recording sessions, and he's Andy Warhol. Mm-hmm. Okay, they acquiesce. They're not happy about this, neither Reed nor Cale, though both will have romantic entanglements with Nico. So Nico's added to the mix, singing a few songs. The pieces are in place. They begin recording in 1966.
Yeah, the recording session was financed by Warhol, so right away he was getting them to places that they might not otherwise have been able to get with their own devices. So they record a bunch of tracks that would end up on the Velvet Underground and Nico a year later for less than $3,000. It's a crappy studio, to put it politely. This is not a very nice studio.
In New York, it's well past its prime, not cutting edge.
So you have to sort of hear the songs through the haze of the non-recording budget. Columbia rejects the record. Atlantic, Elektra, Ahmet Erdogan declines the record specifically because he sees a song called Heroin on the track list. He said, I'm not going to release that record. No way, no how.
Well, it's not a commercial move. It's not a commercial move.
Exactly. Finally, MGM Records owned Verve Records accepts the recordings with the help of somebody on the Verve staff by the name of Tom Wilson. And Jim, I think Tom Wilson's role in the early development of the Velvets was hugely important. I mean, here's a guy who had worked with Dylan, the Mothers of Invention, Cecil Taylor,
Simon and Garfunkel.
This guy had worked with a lot of the greats in that era, and he heard greatness in the Velvet Underground. He says, no, I want to go to bat for this band. We should sign them. We should put this record out. So he re-records a couple of tracks a month later in Hollywood, May of 66. I'm Waiting for the Man, Venus and Furs, Heroin. The record's still not ready. They go back into the studio yet again in November to record a final track, adding Sunday Morning to the mix. That ends up becoming the first single.
That's going to be the hit single.
Right.
That's the
notion. You need a single, boys, you know? Let's get this out.
Sunday morning.
It doesn't happen. When the album comes out, Greg, it spends 1 week at number 199 on the Billboard Top 200 chart and then disappears.
After a break, we're going to dig into the songs that make up the Velvet Underground and Nico, including more about Sunday Morning. We'll also talk about the lasting impact of the album. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.